So I want you to imagine, just for a second, an ancient stone wall.
Okay.
And we're talking like massive 16th century, incredibly heavy blocks of masonry. When you look at a structure like that, there is this undeniable solemnity to it, right? It just feels completely unmovable.
Oh, absolutely. It's totally rigid. I mean, it imposes this kind of absolute silence and order just by existing.
Exactly.
It's the definition of a static, closed space. Like,
oh.
It literally dictates how you're supposed to behave when you stand near it.
Right. But then I want you to imagine that right in front of this solemn, silent stone wall, there's a massive street party.
Okay, quite the contrast.
Yeah, it's the middle of the night, and this huge crowd of people are just dancing salsa at a full blast, sweating, moving, you know, completely losing themselves in the rhythm right there on the asphalt. Suddenly, that dead stone is just vibrating with life.
Wow, yeah, I mean, that's a complete clash of universes right there.
It really is.
The rigid structure and that pulsing life are forced to share the exact same physical space. Conceptually, they should just cancel each other out, you know?
Yeah, totally.
Because one represents pure top-down authority and silence, and the other is pure bottom-up noise and movement and, well, rebellion, really.
And yet they coexist. And that tension, that often hidden colonial tension behind urban architecture, and how the rigid stone of our past collides with the chaotic rhythm of modern city life, that is exactly what we are unpacking today.
It's such a great topic.
It is. We're doing a deep dive into a single, incredibly evocative watercolor painting titled La Merced by the artist Jairo Duque. But we aren't just looking at the artwork itself as some finished, polished object on a gallery wall.
No, we have something much, much more valuable for this.
Yeah, we do.
We're looking at the exact technical specifications of the materials he used, and most importantly, his personal, highly vulnerable studio notes that detail his entire creative process.
Right, which is just gold. So our mission today is to extract that ultimate aha moment about how a city's history isn't just erased by time, it's layered. And we're going to see exactly how modern culture reclaims those seemingly static, frozen spaces. So, okay, let's unpack this.
Well, to really understand how this painting operates, we definitely need to start by looking at where this piece of art was actually born.
Yeah, the location.
Because there is this fascinating geographical disconnect here that, honestly, it shapes every single brushstroke on the final image.
Right, so let's set the scene for you. The painting itself is a portrait of Santiago de Cali. And Cali is this beautifully vibrant, humid, chaotic South American metropolis down in Colombia.
Mm-hmm.
But if you actually look at the technical sheet for this piece, the origin of creation isn't Colombia at all. It says it was painted in December 2024 in Whittier, California.
Right.
And then just to add another layer, it was exhibited in Berlin in January 2025.
What's fascinating here is that the physical location of his studio, Whittier, California, it acted as this necessary creative sanctuary for him.
Sanctuary, yeah.
Duque specifically notes that being thousands of miles away from the daily, just overwhelming reality of Cali actually gave him the mental space he needed.
Interesting.
Yeah, it allowed him to distill the true essence of the city from this massive distance.
I mean, I hear that in theory, but I have to push back a little on this idea of distance equaling clarity.
Okay, fair enough.
Because put yourself in the shoes of someone trying to capture a culture's soul, right? Doesn't being thousands of miles away, locked in some quiet California studio, risk making the art, I don't know, a lot less authentic? Like, he even mentions in his notes that he's looking at web references. I just don't see how you can genuinely capture a city's raw, pulsing street energy, sweat, the exhaust fumes, the overlapping music from all the different storefronts when you're staring at a screen in a sterile room in California.
I get that.
Doesn't he risk painting a nostalgic, romanticized postcard version of Cali rather than the real thing?
It's a very fair skepticism to have, but this is actually where the mechanics of human memory come into play.
Okay, how so?
Well, think about when you are actually standing in the middle of a chaotic metropolis. You are subjected to total sensory overload. You're processing the heat. You're avoiding the traffic. You're smelling the food.
Right, just trying not to get hit by a bus.
Exactly. Your brain is entirely tied up in the immediate practical reality of navigating that physical space.
Yeah.
You basically can't see the forest for the trees. So by retreating to his studio in California, Duque isn't losing the city.
He's not.
No, he's applying a psychological filter to it.
Oh, I see. So the sensory deprivation of the studio forces his brain to pull from his deeper internal archives rather than just reacting to immediate stimuli.
Precisely. The transatlantic distance isolates those internal memories. the immediate noise drops away, and what is left behind is the structural and emotional weight of the city.
Wow, that's wild.
Yeah, he isn't trying to paint a photorealistic map of a street corner. He is painting the psychological impact of the city. He's taking his highly methodical, controlled studio techniques and using them to anchor the vibrant lived experiences he carries inside him.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. The distance essentially strips away the literal truth to get to the emotional truth.
Right.
And to capture that heavy emotional truth, he uses materials that are incredibly specific. And here's where it gets really interesting, because the materials list for this painting reads less like an artist's supply list and more like an architect's blueprint.
Oh, totally.
Let's talk about the paper he chose to paint this on. It is Arches cold pressed, rough grain, 640 gram watercolor paper.
That specific grammage is a massive technical decision. Like, to put that 640 gram number in perspective for you, a standard piece of printer paper on your desk is about 80 grams.
Right, so 640 grams is basically a piece of armor. It is a thick, rigid slab of cotton.
It is.
But why does an artist need paper that heavy just to paint a picture of a church and some dancers?
Because of the violence of his process.
The violence.
Yeah, standard watercolor paper will just warp and buckle when you apply heavy amounts of water to it. It creates these weird hills and valleys, and the paint ends up pooling unevenly.
And it gets all wavy and ruined.
Exactly. But Duke isn't just painting a light, delicate landscape here. He subjects this paper to intense, soaking washes of water and heavy physical scraping.
Mm.
If you use standard paper, it would physically disintegrate on his desk.
Wow!
Yeah, the 640 gram paper stays flat and unyielding, very much like a slab of rock.
So it's almost like the artist is using the heavy 640 gram paper as actual colonial masonry. Like, you need a bulletproof foundation to hold the historical weight of a structure that was built in 1536.
That is a perfect analogy. He is physically reconstructing the massive weight of colonial architecture right there on his desk. And the texture of the paper is just as crucial as its weight.
The rough grain part.
Right. When paper is cold pressed and rough grain, the surface isn't smooth and flat. If you were to look at it under a microscope, it's this rugged terrain full of tiny little valleys, ridges, and microscopic caverns.
Which plays directly into his choice of paint. The technical sheet specifically names Daniel Smith watercolors.
Yes. Daniel Smith pigments are very famous among watercolorists for a very specific chemical property, which is natural granulation.
Granulation?
Yes. So many commercial watercolor paints are manufactured to be very smooth, almost like a dye. They spread evenly. But granulating pigments are made from heavier, raw minerals.
Okay, so they don't just dissolve into the water, they maintain their physical properties.
Exactly. When you mix these heavy granulating pigments with water and drop them onto that rough 640 gram paper, the heavy mineral particles physically fall out of suspension.
Oh, wow.
Gravity literally pulls them down, and they settle deeply into those microscopic caverns on the rough paper you mentioned.
So he's basically letting gravity and the water do the work of a few centuries of erosion?
Basically, yeah.
That's a highly uncontrollable process for an artist to choose. I mean, usually you want your paint to go exactly where you put it. But here, the paint is physically settling into the paper the exact same way dirt, pollution, and moisture settle into an old stone wall over centuries.
You've hit the nail on the head. Through the actual chemistry of the granulating watercolor and the rugged texture of the paper, He isn't just drawing a picture of an old wall. The materials themselves are physically imitating the porosity, the wear, and the humidity of ancient 16th century stone. The chemistry is doing half the historical storytelling before he even paints a recognizable architectural shape.
It's like structural engineering disguised as painting. And speaking of the structure, if you look at the chronological way he painted this piece, as detailed in his notes, it acts as a literal time lapse of the city's evolution.
It really does. Duke details a very deliberate timeline in his process. He started by painting the heavy, low, grounded stone of the Lumerset Church first.
And Lumerset is super important.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Now, Lumerset isn't just any building. It is the foundational kilometer zero of Santiago de Cali. It was established way back in 1536.
Which means it was the literal starting point for the Spanish colonial grid. Like, they planted that church, and the entire layout of the modern city expanded outward from that exact spot. And ironically, today, that church functions as a museum housing both pre-Columbian artifacts and colonial art. So it's a literal physical box of history sitting right in the middle of the city.
Precisely. And Duke felt he had to anchor that past onto the heavy paper first. It had to be the foundation of the painting, just as it was the foundation of the city.
Right.
Only after that historical anchor was painted, dried, and firmly established did he move on to paint the background.
Okay.
And the background consists of these modern, cold, vertical gray skyscrapers rising up menacingly behind the ancient church.
Okay, I have to jump in here because to the average person, if you see a squat colonial stone church sitting directly in front of a giant modern glass and steel skyscraper, that is a total visual cliche.
I mean, sure, it happens a lot.
You see that exact framing in London, you see it in Madrid, you see it in Boston with Trinity Church and the Hancock Tower. It's totally a trope. What makes this specific painting and Duke's approach to it not just another generic juxtaposition of old architecture versus new architecture?
It's a great observation. And the distinction really lies in the relationship between the two structures.
Okay.
In a cliche, those two elements, the ancient church and the modern skyscraper, they're usually presented as if they're fighting a turf war over the soul of the city. The skyscraper is portrayed as the aggressive bully crushing the past, or the church is the stubborn relic refusing to move for progress.
Right. It's always framed as a battle.
Exactly. But Duke explicitly rejects that conflict. He uses a specific musical term in his notes to describe their relationship. He calls it counterpoint.
Counterpoint. Like in classical composition or complex jazz, where two completely different melodies are played at the exact same time.
Right. They are independent. They are rhythmically different. But they aren't fighting for dominance. They actually balance each other to create a richer overall harmony.
Oh, I like that.
If we connect this to the bigger picture of how urban history actually functions, cities don't operate on a straight, neat timeline where the new simply paves over the old. Time piles up. It accumulates. Different eras and different architectural ideologies are forced into a tense but absolutely necessary coexistence.
So you're saying the modern skyscrapers actually need the 1536 church, like they rely on it?
They absolutely do. Think about how architecture impacts our local cultural identity. The modern vertical city frames the past, giving it a modern context. But equally, that old 1536 church anchors the modern skyscrapers.
Yeah, without the anchor, what happened?
Without that historical, localized anchor, the city risks becoming what anthropologists call a non-place, a generic, soulless grid of glass and concrete that could literally be anywhere in the world. I mean, a financial district in Tokyo looks a lot like a financial district in Chicago.
Oh, totally.
A tension between the horizontal ancient stone of La Merced and the vertical modern glass behind it is what gives Cali its specific, unrepeatable identity.
So they hold each other hostage, but in an incredibly productive way. They prevent each other from becoming irrelevant or generic. I love that framework.
It's brilliant.
But that brings us to the most visually disruptive part of this entire painting, because we have this very solemn structural balance between the church and the skyscrapers, and then Duke introduces an element that completely shatters that silence.
You're talking about the street level.
The street level. When you look at the painting as a whole, the vast majority of the canvas is dominated by these dark, abyssal blues and deep blacks. It's a very heavy, cold night scene.
Right.
But right there on the street, a street his notes identify as the Carrera Quarta, which is locally famous as the Calle del Sabor, or the Street of Flavor, there is this violent, explosive interruption of bright yellow and pure white spots of light.
And it's really crucial to note that those spots of light aren't streetlights, and they aren't the headlights of passing cars either.
No. The artist's notes reveal that these glowing, formless spots of warm light represent salsa dancers. And what's wild is that he didn't paint literal human figures. Like, if you zoom in, there are no faces, there are no detailed bodies, there are no cliche, ruffled salsa dresses. It is just pure, radiating light, contrasting sharply against the cold, rigid colonial stone of the buildings.
This raises an important question about how official history and living culture negotiate with one another in a physical space.
Yeah.
To understand why he painted the dancers as formless light,
yeah,
you have to think about the psychology of the medium he chose. We need to compare the philosophical difference between oil paint and watercolor.
Okay, let's explore that, because they behave completely differently on a canvas.
Absolutely. Think about how oil paint was traditionally used, especially during the colonial eras of the 16th and 17th centuries. Oil paint was the medium of monarchs, you know, of official state portraits, of religious dogma.
Right.
Why? Because oil allows for complete control. It dries slowly. It is thick and opaque. Mm. If you make a mistake, you can scrape it off or just paint right over it. You can endlessly correct and force the paint to project a perfect, idealized image.
It's the ultimate medium of authority. You dictate exactly what the viewer sees.
Conceptually, yes. Oil paint represents top-down control.
Mm.
It perfectly mirrors the rigidity of colonial history itself. impose laws, straight lines, rigid social hierarchies, and massive stone walls built to dominate the landscape and project enduring power.
But watercolor, I mean, watercolor is a totally different animal. It doesn't listen to you the way oil does.
Exactly. Watercolor represents the stain. Water has a will of its own. When you put water and pigment onto a piece of paper, it bleeds, it expands unpredictably, it finds the path of least resistance.
Yeah.
You can try to guide it, but you cannot absolutely control it.
It's rebellious. It ignores the boundaries you try to set for it.
It is entirely rebellious. It represents the bottom-up popular culture, the fluid, living, unpredictable rhythm of the people on the street. By using the bleeding, uncontrollable nature of watercolor to depict the salsa dancers as pure light, Duke proves visually that rigid historical walls are always permeable. The top-down colonial history is constantly forced to negotiate with the bottom-up cultural rhythm. The space wasn't designed for a massive street party, but the culture reclaims the asphalt anyway.
So what does this all mean? It means the artist was trying to capture a nearly impossible contradiction.
Definitely.
Trying to paint the rigid, unforgiving lines of 16th century architectural history and the completely fluid, spontaneous movement of salsa dancers at the exact same time. It's like trying to mentally hum a strict, square military march while forcing your feet to dance a frantic guaguanco.
Well, that's a great way to put it.
And for those who don't know, a guaguanco is a deeply syncopated, rhythmically complex Cuban rumba. It is incredibly fast and unpredictable. Trying to hold both the military march and the guaguanco in your head at once creates this immense friction. It's two completely different languages clashing on the same piece of paper.
And that clash, that field of negotiation, as Duke beautifully calls it in his notes, is the true soul of the city. The modern salsa dancers aren't trying to literally tear down the 1536 church. They are flowing around it, interacting with it, softening it. They're reclaiming a space that was originally built to intimidate them.
Right.
The official static memory of the city might be written in heavy stone, but the living, breathing memory of the city is written in the fluid movement of the people today.
It's absolutely incredible when you step back and look at the whole picture we've just built. We are talking about a piece of thick cotton paper, some water, and some heavy mineral pigment sitting on a desk in a quiet, isolated studio in Whittier, California.
So it's just materials.
Right. But through the sheer physical chemistry of those materials and the artist's profound understanding of how distance filters memory, it manages to capture the entire layered, complicated soul of a metropolis thousands of miles away.
It serves as a powerful reminder to you, the listener, that a city is never a locked museum. Architecture's impact on local identity is profound, but it isn't permanent or static.
Not at all.
The city is an open stage. We often look at the towering modern glass skyscrapers dominating our skylines today and think of them as the ultimate final endpoint of progress. But the cycle of history piling up, layer by layer, never stops. Someday, those pristine glass towers will inevitably be the old, forgotten ruins of a new era.
They'll just be the old stone wall in the background of someone else's painting in a few hundred years.
Exactly. The next time you are on your daily commute or just walking through your town, try to view the asphalt and the buildings of your own neighborhood with new eyes.
Look for the layers.
Yes, look for those layers of time. Look for where the rigid, outdated planning of the past meets the fluid, messy reality of how people actually use that space today.
It really makes you rethink the ground you walk on every day. You start seeing the negotiations happening on every single street corner. But I want to leave you with one final thought to mull over, taking everything we've learned from Duke's painting and pushing it just one step further into the future.
I love it. Where are we taking this?
Well, we talked about how physical salsa dancing is the way citizens today reclaim and soften the rigid 16th century stone of the past. But what about right now? How might the digital layers of our cities act as the new watercolors redefining our physical architecture?
Oh, that's fascinating. You mean like the invisible data and networks we generate just by moving around?
Exactly. Think about our invisible GPS paths tracking where we congregate. Think about viral flash mobs that suddenly repurpose a sterile corporate plaza into a dance floor for 10 minutes.
Yeah.
Or augmented reality apps that paint digital graffiti over solemn historical monuments through the lens of a smartphone. These things aren't made of stone. They aren't even made of water and pigment. They are completely intangible, yet they dictate how we move, how we feel, and how we interact with the rigid grid of the modern city.
They really are the ultimate fluid, unpredictable medium.
Right. So the question is, will future archaeologists dig through our data servers to understand how we secretly danced around the rigid monuments of the 21st century? When they look back at our era, what will be the solemn dead stone wall, and what will be the vibrant, invisible rhythm vibrating right in front of it?
That is a brilliant question to end on.